This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour this Thursday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Coming up this half hour, you're going to find out why confidence among South Australian wine businesses is dropping, despite the value of Australian wine exports increasing. New table grape standards could mean consistently sweet grapes at the supermarket this summer. And also this lunchtime, if you take part in recreational hunting, how would you feel about being part of a feral pig cull?
I think Sporting Shoes has 200,000-odd members Australia-wide, and there's about 60,000-odd in Queensland. Most of those do hunt at some stage, some just target shoot, and there's a lot of people that would be prepared to go out there, but they've got jobs and businesses to run, so it depends what the government's prepared to do.
We'll have more on that after the weather. We're also going to be speaking to Primary Industries Minister Tim Whetstone about fruit fly, because it seems like the message just isn't sinking in with that. One in five Victorian drivers were pulled over at a random roadblock at Bordertown in the lead up to the October long weekend, and they were found concealing fruit and copped a $375 fine. So we're going to be talking about what needs to change there. But before we speak to the minister, confidence among South Australian wine businesses has decreased, with energy costs and water reliability a big concern. That's according to the annual SA Wine Snapshot, which also found businesses were finding it difficult to find staff. Earlier, I spoke to Brian Smedley, the chief executive of the South Australian Wine Industry Association.
Look, I think that generally we would suggest that there's possibly been a little bit of a decline in business confidence overall, but that extent, I think, just goes to show that there can be some fairly strong issues at play, particularly when costs continue to go up. And I guess the most recent vintage that we had, where a number of regions would have had declining yields.
And which regions in particular?
So Adelaide Hills, the Barossa, and Clare Valley particularly had a lesser yield than they did the year before.
Because it is fair to say, I mean, things have been looking pretty rosy when you look at it in terms of exports. Australian wine exports have continued to increase, and prices are much better than where they have been. What are you putting this, underconfidence down to?
Look, I think the issue in a generalised statement like we've just heard, is that export is not for everybody. And so we would have about 30% of our businesses that wouldn't export, and so they rely primarily on the local domestic market. And so I guess in that instance, they're not necessarily seeing increases in sales, because we know that in Australia, alcohol consumption, particularly wine, is pretty flat, and that therefore competition is fairly strong in relation to trying to get your product noticed, and whether it be a restaurant, whether it be a retail shelf. And so sales, are still competitively difficult. So I think, the old adage of wine's easy to make, it's harder to sell, still apply.
Other things that you've cited are energy costs and water access and reliability. I mean, with that first one, I mean, what are the energy costs that an average grape grower faces?
Well, I think the issue is, and that's relative to how they operate their business, but, there's going to be a whole range of energy that's used in a grape growing business, from whether they've got to pump water, how they access that water, whether they do have various other bits and pieces on site where they need that energy. So it depends on how they're using it and what source of energy they are using.
But, I mean, in terms of the big wine businesses, I mean, their bills would be in the hundreds of thousands to millions. But your average grape grower, I mean, what sort of increases have they faced in the past few years?
Well, I think the question we're actually asking is covering grape growers, and then we've talked about wineries. I mean, wineries have significant costs, obviously, particularly in terms of refrigeration. But we've seen significant costs, probably anything up to 60 to 80% for some producers over the last 4 or 5 years. So they are significantly costs that, you know, are hard to absorb, particularly when margins are still slim.
And interestingly, I mean, despite those concerns, there is a vineyard expansion planned. I mean, how much and where in the state?
Well, I think the issue for us at the moment is to recognise that those are primarily relating to disease pressures, as you know, and disease vines that need to come out potentially, and this is an opportunity for those businesses to do that, as well as to change the varietal mix, and that basically goes to consumer demand, recognising that if you're going to make a decision about that, it's going to take a little while for those vines to yield sufficiently to make wine. So, you know, from that point of view, it is a significant decision made by a business. But you'll find that there'll be relatively changes across the state, recognising that, you know, that level of investment in new vineyards and or reworking existing vineyards is still only around about 1% of the total.
Because at the same time, you've got growers in the Riverland who are ripping out their vines.
Look, I think the issue that it needs to always look at is you're always looking at whether vineyards are profitable, whether there is a needing to look at alternative crops, indeed, as to whether you look at alternative varieties.
Another statistic in that snapshot was that almost half of those who were surveyed are having difficulty recruiting staff. Why is that?
Look, I think that there's a number of factors. We have to recognise that the wine industry is largely a regional employer. Each of those regions have different proximities to the city of Adelaide, where the majority of population is. And so it's going to be difficult to, firstly, attract people to your region. And secondly, I guess, if you do attract someone, they usually come with a partner. And does that partner need work and can they find work? If they come as a family unit, then is their schooling sufficient?
Just lastly, on water access and security, we heard from a winemaker yesterday from Langhorne Creek, basically saying that the Murray-Darling Basin plan needs to be followed and continued and not stepped away from. I mean, and we've also heard how there's an ACCC inquiry looking into companies like Duxton, who are accused of hostaging basically water and keeping that away from farmers. I mean, what are your concerns around the future of water access for the wine and grape industry?
Well, I think the issue for water is that we simply are starting to have conversations that it is going to constrain our industry if we don't have proper access. It's a finite resource, and I guess we just need to make sure that it's available at a cost that's viable. But it's also about what are the sources of water that we can access, and are we actually utilising all of the water sources? By that I mean, you know, instead of reclaimed water, that might be a possibility, but there's a cost, obviously, in getting it to some regions.
That was Brian Smedley, the Chief Executive of the South Australian Wine Industry Association. Well, have you ever gone to the shops to buy a bunch of grapes, only to find that they're a bit sour or not quite ripe enough? Not a great feeling. It's been a problem for the industry for a long time, particularly early in the season when growers are keen to send off their fruit first to try and get a premium before prices drop. But now the industry has set new minimum maturity standards, which aim to make sure all fruit is picked with the same sweet taste. Cherie von Hirschner spoke with Australian Table Grape Association CEO Jeff Scott, who says it's the first time retailers across the country will have the same guidelines.
Commence at the start of our domestic season from northern Queensland and Western Australia. They'll commence harvest toward or mid-October towards the end of October. It affects all varieties. We have two standards, one for the majority of varieties at 16 bricks in terms of maturity, and Menindi from up north in Queensland at 15.5 bricks.
And why have you decided to do this?
What we've done over the last 2 years is extensive research in terms of on-farm sampling before the grapes go to the market. We've also taken random sampling from supermarket shelves, and we've also consulted with the consumers as to what would be their best acceptability of a good eating grape. As a result of that, we've ended up with a minimum maturity standard for our industry.
Comparing it to what the standards are, the current standards, how different is it?
Well, there's been a variety of standards from the supermarkets. Each of the individual independent retailers have got their own standards, but the standards are an average. So if they had an average of 16, that means some of the berries could be 18, 19 bricks, but some of the berries could be at 11, 12 bricks, which would make it very immature and sour to eat. Now we've set the standard at a minimum of 16, so every berry has got to be 16 or above.
So for those who don't know, what is the brick? What is that?
That's a measure of sugars in the and sweetness in the grape. So that basically determines the taste.
So it sounds like it's a move to stop growers from sending fruit to supermarkets too early, where if it's not ripe, or you know, if the grapes aren't ripe, it potentially puts customers off.
That's correct. I mean, it's a way of making sure that the growers pick the fruit at the optimum maturity, where we know that the consumer will accept that that taste. So it's a win-win for both the growers and the consumer. The growers know that when they send the fruit to the supermarkets or to exports, that the consumers will, majority of the consumers, over 80%, will accept that taste. And we've found with our research that consumers are prepared to pay a higher price for good quality grapes. If that is consistent, well, then it's a win-win.
Thinking about the grapes, if they're not at the right maturity level, how long does it take for a customer who might have been put off by that to try it again? How does it affect the market, in your view?
Yeah, with our research that we've done also in that area, we have found that if the consumer purchases a grape which is immature, it's a minimum of 6 weeks before they will come back to repurchase those grapes.
Okay, and so in terms of these new standards, how will you monitor this, and what will be the requirements for growers to do it?
Well, we have talked about having a clearance certificate from the growers, but we're more likely talking to the supermarkets at their distribution centres, where as the grapes arrive there, they certainly do independent testing, and they will be monitoring it from an industry perspective.
So will there be any costs associated with these new standards?
Well, supermarkets do their own quality check and monitoring, so we're incorporating it into their program. If we want to extend the program, well, there may be some additional resources that are required in terms of the testing, but that's something that we'll work through. But we're certainly getting it out there to grapes, to all the growers. They're on board with this because they know that they'll benefit in the long run.
With those new minimum standards, is there any flexibility to those?
Each year we'll assess the climatic conditions and the weather patterns, etc. We'll look at the water issues and so on. So depending on the climate and the conditions, there is a possibility that the minimum standard may vary. This has come about by a consultative process through the major retailers and the major suppliers to the supermarkets. So it's not as if it's an industry standard that has very little consultation with everybody engaged and involved in the industry. Certainly been to that extent, and that's where we've all agreed on the standard.
That's Australian Table Grape Association CEO Jeff Scott. It's 18 past 12.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, let's head to the Riverland now and have a look at what's happening with stone fruit out there, because Riverland growers are monitoring high sugar levels in their stone fruit, a promising sign for a good season ahead. Executive Officer for Summer Fruits SA, Tim Grieger, says while water insecurity and labour costs still pose an issue, the industry is looking forward to strong market results.
Well, it's off to a pretty good start, given where we're at this time of the year. The harvesting is just starting on the early varieties and nectarines, and one grower I spoke to today started yesterday, and another one late last week. So it's going well. The crop load is probably good average, or perhaps a bit better this year. Quality seems to be excellent for the start of the season. In fact, the flavours and the sugar level of the early varieties is as good as you'd want. It's very tasty. So that's really good for early varieties. Always hard to get that sugar level up early, but going well so far. In terms of any issues like pests and diseases, pretty low this year. It's weather's been very conducive to that sort of not being an issue at this time of the year.
What sort of conditions do you need to get a good sugar level?
Sunlight, warmth. It depends on the variety, and it depends on, I guess, how a grower treats the fruit toward harvest and the picking time and that sort of thing. And varieties as well, of course. Some struggle, others will get sugar level well. And it's a seasonal thing too.
So walk me through what happens now. Started harvest for some varieties. What's the next step?
Of course, all growers are looking to what the market outlook might be. And at this stage, indication is that it could be good, at least early season. And that's always important for growers to get into a good market result early season. Costs are always a factor. We know the issues about around water, but costs in terms of thinning is high. The impact of loading is affecting some growers, depending on their work structure and their how they have to work. So that is a concern. But in general, we're looking at a successful season.
And those costs there, we're talking water, we're talking labour. How's it looking in terms of Riverland growers? There's been some rumours that people are cutting off water to their trees. Is that a pervasive issue that we're going to see continue across Riverland growers?
Look, I don't know the detail of individual growers and their situations, but I've heard those comments as well, and it is of concern. And water is an issue, I guess, we can talk all afternoon about, but the bottom line is it is quite serious, it's quite significant, and it is impacting many, many growers quite seriously, and that's of great concern going forward. I mean, we've been through tough times in this region many, many times and come through and continue on into the future. And let's hope that is the case again. And of course, with the water situation, a good seasonal rainfall will turn things around. So you can't predict those things. And as growers do, we're in the industry for the long term. And we're in it because we love it. We enjoy the challenge of what is. But we struggle with those cost factors that we feel sometimes impact us more than they should.
That's Summer Fruits SA Tim Gregas speaking to Grace Whiteside. Another thing that impacts, obviously, the fruit industry's fruit fly. We're going to talk about that on the Country Hour now, because have you been stung by South Australia's zero tolerance fruit fly fines? Now, the zero tolerance approach has been in place since the start of the year, so you may think that after nearly 11 months this message would have gotten through, but it doesn't seem like that's quite the case, because the government says that one in five Victorian drivers pulled over at a border town random roadblock in the lead up to the October long weekend were found concealing fruit, and they copped a $375 fine. We're joined now by Primary Industries Minister Tim Whetstone. Welcome, Minister.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Why is the no fruit in SA message not sinking in?
Well, it is disappointing, particularly at the border town roadblock over a long weekend just recently gone past, that we had were 145 drivers that were caught bringing fruit into South Australia. It means that we're going to have to do more to educate visitors coming into South Australia, so that, you know, we want people to come to South Australia and have a good experience, and I don't want to have visitors going away with a tarnished view that they came to South Australia and received a fine. But, you know, I guess understanding that, as you've said, it's been in place now since the beginning of the year. We are enacting the zero tolerance approach to protect our horticulture industry here in South Australia, because the point of difference is we are fruit fly free.
But given it's been in place for nearly a year, I mean, what needs to be done to stop this? Do you need to make clearer signs?
Well, look, there is ample opportunity with signage, with bins, declaration bins, before they get to the random roadblocks. So, you know, people, again, we'll have to be less ignorant of the rules. Our biosecurity rules are very, very straightforward. That is, don't bring fruit and vegetables into South Australia.
So do you think it is a case of ignorance, and not what has long been the approach for people travelling over, is that you can turn fruit over once you get to those checking stations, but now you're getting fined? Are you saying it's more ignorance rather than people just so used to what has been a long-time approach of you can hand it over once you get to the station?
No, look, I think, to be fair, there has been a long-standing, understanding that they can use their random roadblocks as rubbish bins or dumping grounds for their fruit. But those, changed. And, you know, we have to, I guess, send that message out there so that people can't be classified as being ignorant or not aware of those rule changes. And, you know, I'm not wanting to be giving out any fines. My job would be accomplished if we were giving out no fines and we continue to keep our finger on the pulse when it comes to keeping our South Australia fruit fly free. So what I would say is that, yes, those 145 drivers were issued with a $375 fine, but I want to be able to go out there with a better message, better education, so that everyone that comes to South Australia is fully aware that they leave their fruit and veg at home because they can buy really good quality fruit and vegetables when they get into South Australia.
What does that mean and what does that look like? Is that getting to people in Melbourne? Is that making really obvious and more frequent signs saying no fruit in SA or you're going to get a $375 fine?
Well, look, there are a number of ways that we can do that. Whether we're putting notifications on people's phones when they come into South Australia, whether it's something that pops up on a GPS or on a navigation device, or whether it's we you know, sell that message to the fruit retailers and wholesalers right around the country, letting people know that you know, South Australia is fruit fly free and please be a part of it. So you know, there are different ways that we can send that message and sell the benefits of being fruit fly free. And if everyone takes some ownership of that, not only will they feel better about it, but they'll also have money in their pocket if they don't get a fine.
Now, you say it's one in five Victorian drivers that were pulled over and fined, but it's not just Victorian drivers that have been fined. I know that there are South Australians who know that fruit fly, like they have also been fined. I mean, of those 145 drivers that were caught, how many of those were South Australian?
Well, that is a very good question. That's something that I will get the information from the department on. But yes, you are right. It's not just you know, Victorian and visiting visitors or visitors coming into South Australia from other states. We do have an element of South Australians either not aware or being ignorant or relying on what they have always done, and that is drop their fruit off at the roadblock station. So, you know, again, the message needs to be out there, needs to be a much stronger message so that people are aware. And we'll continue to work with you know, with the visitors or the visiting population.
But you don't sorry to interrupt, but you don't. It is something that we requested from your department yesterday when we lined this interview up. You don't have the breakdown between South Australia and Victoria when it comes to fines given out?
Well, look, I'm sorry, no, I don't. The department haven't briefed me exactly what the breakdown of where the people come from, but I'll make sure that I get that information to you so that your listeners can understand. It's not just visitation from other states. You know, it's our local people that are also putting a horticulture industry at risk. And you know, we're doing our best to keep our market advantage alive, and that is being fruit fly free. But, you know, everyone has to play a part, whether you are a South Australian or whether you are an interstate visitor. You know, South Australians should know better. This initiative has been, you know, on your show a number of times. It's been in the papers. It's been a conversation piece, you know, for a long period of time. And if people continue to ignore that, they'll continue to be part of the, you know, getting issued with fines. And that's not what I want to see. I want to be able to, you know, be pleased to hear that we're seeing a continual reduction of people coming in here without fruit and vegetables.
Minister, a text here from, well, it's anonymous here, but it's saying Ceduna has no bins prior to checkpoint for fruit fly. Is that correct?
That is correct. We are giving the visitors an opportunity to come in through Ceduna that they can declare their fruit.
So why is there an exception for Ceduna for people coming across that way?
Well, when people come in through Ceduna from the west, they are not putting or having any opportunity to bring Queensland fruit fly. The issues over in the west are that the Mediterranean fruit fly is the threat. And to date, we've had little pressure on our borders, albeit that we have had a Mediterranean fruit fly declaration earlier this year. But we'll continue to to work towards a zero-tolerance approach at all of our entry points into South Australia. But it is very costly, and we also have to understand that while we initiate the zero-tolerance approach at the Yamba border entry point, we will roll out the zero-tolerance approach at all of our entry points into South Australia.
Minister... So I just want to put, I know that because we're about to get to news headlines, but I just wanted to put one more text to you from Phil from Ardrossan saying, we find the changed rules confusing about fruit we are travelling with. Why can't we dump fruit when we get to the roadblock now? Because now it's the case that you get a fine.
Well, I think the message is very clear. Don't bring fruit and vegetables into South Australia. If you are travelling into the Riverland and you have purchased your fruit in South Australia, you can... bring your docket with you and you'll be allowed to continue your journey. But it's a very, very straightforward, clear message. Do not bring fruit and vegetables into South Australia. If you are travelling within South Australia, make sure you take your receipt with you.
Minister, thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
My pleasure.
That is Primary Industries Minister Tim Whetstone. Are you with Phil? Are you a bit confused by this? Have you been caught out by this, zero tolerance with the fruit fly? 0467 922 783. I mean, this has been in place for nearly a year. What do you think the government should be doing to just make sure that this message is super clear? 0467 922 783 if you'd like to have your say. Let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Lucy Robinson.
Good afternoon, Isabella. Federal Labor has accused the National Party of pushing for drought spending for political gain. The Nationals are urging the government to spend $1.3 billion on drought-affected communities. Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon says it will give Nationals MPs the ability to spend money for political capital. A former racehorse trainer says she alerted Racing New South Wales to concerns the animals were being sold at horse sales in Sydney's southwest to a kill buyer in 2018. The ABC has obtained emails between Sandra Jorgensen and the racing regulator from June last year, saying she witnessed a clearly branded two-year-old filly being sold at the Camden horse sales to a kill buyer. The emails contradict statements made by Racing New South Wales to the ABC's 7:30 program, denying it had any prior knowledge of what happened. And a truck driver has escaped injury after he hit five camels on the Eyre Highway about 50 kilometres before the Western Australian border. The accident happened just before 10 o'clock, but police say the truck has now been moved off the road and there are no traffic hazards. There'll be more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Lucy. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're going to be talking about, you might have heard yesterday about this feral pig cull that the NFF is pitching to the government, trying to get some funding for that. Well, we're going to hear from Australia's peak recreational shooting body. They say that they'll be willing to support a national feral pig cull, but only if the program is adequately resourced and coordinated. Keen also to get your thoughts on fruit fly as well. This text here referring to the 145 drivers that were fined at that border town roadblock, saying 145 visitors that will not return to South Australia, just revenue raising, need better promotion. 0467 922 783 if you'd like to have your say. Let's head off. We will be going to the Weather Bureau shortly, but we should mention that with these very hot and dry conditions today, there are total fire bans in place for the following places today: the Northwest Pastoral, the West Coast, the Eastern and Lower Eyre Peninsula, the Flinders, Mid North, Mount Lofty Ranges, York Peninsula, Kangaroo Island and the Lower South East. And where total fire bans have been declared, very hazardous fire weather conditions are predicted and the total fire ban will apply until midnight tonight. And the Weather Bureau has also issued a fire weather warning. Let's head off to the Bureau now. And it's good afternoon to Senior Forecaster Simon Timke.
Hi, Isabella.
Now, what is happening? There's a lot going on warning-wise with the weather, but what's happening?
Yeah, there is. We've got hot conditions right across the state with, almost right across the state with those pretty strong northerly winds. At this point, they're the strongest in the west and the north, ahead of a cold front, which is just moving across the far west of the state now. It's moved through Nullarbor, where we saw the temperature, as it moved through, we saw the temperature drop from around 29 to about 21 degrees, and the winds went right round to a southwesterly. So it came through Nullarbor early enough that it hadn't got too hot there, but places further east are much hotter. At the moment, we're sitting on about 39 degrees at Ceduna, quite a few places across Eyre Peninsula in the 35 to 38 degree range, and Ceduna, probably the hottest place across the state right now, but a lot of places well into the mid-30s, even down in the southeast of the state, into the low to mid-30s, some 32s and 33s down that way, and Kangaroo Island getting a few spots in the 30s as well, as an indication of how warm that air mass is. We're starting to see some dust as well. We can pick up some dust over parts of the northeast pastoral district on our satellite images, and also heard that there is dust at William Creek as well. So getting with those stronger winds and the hot conditions, it is getting pretty dusty over some parts as well. As you say, we've got quite a lot of warnings out. I heard you mention the fire weather warning and the total fire bans that the CFS has got out. We've also got marine warnings out for all our coastal waters, strong wind warning out for all the coastal waters. And we're just starting to see a little bit of thunderstorm activity develop up to the northwest of Ceduna. So they'll be close to where the front is right now, I think. So we will be keeping an eye on them. There is potential for some severe gusts in thunderstorms this afternoon. So do keep an eye out for warnings there, because I think that we will be considering warnings for severe gusts in thunderstorms this afternoon. And also a slight chance that there could be a severe gust in the southwesterly winds following the change as well. So although we don't have any warnings out for those winds now, we will be watching them closely during the afternoon. So keep an eye on our website for any warnings associated with those winds. Now, the front that's driving the weather, moving across the west and most of the central parts of the state today, if you can imagine a line from about Oodnadatta to Lee Creek to Mount Gambier, that's where I expect the front will be near by about midnight or thereabouts. So moving over most of western central parts of the state and some parts of the east there as well. We've talked about dust, and I think the dust is even possible in the southwesterlies, particularly over inland parts, with those winds being pretty strong there. So dust on and off in some places during the day. Possible shower and thunderstorm today as well, ahead of and following the change. Unlikely to get much in the way of rainfall totals out of it. They'll be very high base thunderstorms and showers, so I don't think that that we'll see any significant totals hitting the ground out of them, unfortunately. So by Friday, that front will be right up in the very far northeast of the state, and we'll see a significantly colder air mass coming in behind the front. I think a lot of places that see the front move across today will see maximum temperatures tomorrow that'll be 15 to 20 degrees lower than the maximum temperatures that we'll see today. So significantly colder day over most parts tomorrow. Right up in the far northeast, where the front's a little bit slower to go through, probably still be quite hot ahead of that change. But I think by afternoon, that change will have even moved through the far northeast. So for Friday, we're still forecasting the slight chance of showers and possible thunderstorms over central and eastern districts, and also east of about the Stuart Highway over northern parts, and all that weather contracting northeastwards during the morning as the front moves away to the northeast as well. Further south, we'll see showers in the onshore airstream following today's front. Generally a slight chance, but grading to a medium high chance of showers over the southern agricultural area, and as you move a little bit further north, just a slight chance over the northern agricultural area. As I mentioned, much colder conditions following, and there's a second little front approaching the lower southeast late Friday, moving across that district overnight Friday, and the coldest air is associated with that feature. So on Friday evening, I think, with a chance of seeing a thunderstorm over the lower southeast, possibly with some small hail as well. So that's Friday evening and the early hours of Saturday morning. Still a chance there could be a little bit of dust over central and eastern parts of the northern agricultural area on Friday, also the Flinders District and the northeast pastoral district. The wind's still pretty strong. They'll be southwest to southerly, but a bit more westerly in the south. And right up in the far northeast of the state, the north to northwesterly winds will still be there ahead of that change. So still a little bit windy tomorrow, but probably not quite as windy as today. And then on Saturday, we'll see a little bit more significant easing in the winds and the shower activity just over the southern agricultural area, just a slight to medium chance, but a bit more likely about the southeast district. So forecasting a medium to high chance of showers about the southeast districts. Still a chance of that thunderstorm and small hail about the lower southeast during the morning, and conditions generally cold in the south, grading to mild in the far north for Saturday. The winds moderate to fresh southwest to southerly. They'll be pretty fresh to strong near southern coast at first, possibly even reaching gale force near the southeast coast on Saturday morning, but then generally easing throughout the day. On Sunday, we'll be under a high pressure ridge by then, so significant further easing of the winds and enough for there to be a little bit of frost patches around the mid-north and Flinders districts early on Sunday morning. Other than that, just a slight chance of showers south of about Adelaide, increasing to a medium chance of showers about the lower southeast district. And then through the early part of next week, conditions generally dry, still a little bit cold on Monday morning, and a chance of a little bit of frost around parts of the mid-north and the upper southeast district. But during the day on Monday, dry conditions and mostly sunny with generally light winds. Through Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, conditions generally getting hotter over those few days ahead of a change that will reach move over western parts on Thursday. So gradually seeing temperatures rise over that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday period as those northerly winds start to bring a bit of hotter air from the north over southern parts. But I think through that three-day period, conditions generally remaining dry as those temperatures rise a little bit. Rainfall totals for the four-day period out to midnight Monday, generally not too great. Most places, I think, would receive less than a millimetre or two, with perhaps some falls of 2 to 5 millimetres with thunderstorms and also about southern coasts and ranges, and some slightly higher falls possible about the lower southeast district where we might see some local falls of 5 to 10 millimetres, Isabella.
Thanks, Simon. It is a busy day indeed. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. For the Upper Western District, tomorrow will be a partly cloudy day with a slight chance of a shower in the west and a near zero chance elsewhere. There'll be areas of raised dust and the chance of a thunderstorm. It's not going to get very cool at nighttime, temperatures dropping to between 19 and 24. And then during the day, it's going to reach the low to high 30s. And then for the Lower Western District, a partly cloudy day with a slight chance of a shower. Again, there will be areas of raised dust and the chance of a thunderstorm. Overnight, it'll fall to 16 and 20, or between 16 and 23. And then during the day, it will reach 28 to 34.
The Saturday Quiz with Deb Tribe.
I thought he was possibly from an African country. Am I on the right track?
I can't give you any right track answers, Amanda. I'll get into big trouble if I do.
Oh, blimey. I caught the tail end of it.
Saturdays from 10:30.
Oh, my God. I haven't got a clue.
Gary, so close.
I don't know.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
Where it is 16 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Thanks for your company today. Well, Australia's peak recreational shooting body says it would be willing to support a national feral pig cull if the program was adequately resourced and coordinated. The Sporting Shooters Association of Australia has about 200,000 members nationally, including many who take part in recreational hunting. It also has a specialist unit which manages coordinated culling programs. President of the Queensland Conservation and Wildlife Management Division of the association, Damien Ferguson, says the organisation could have an important role to play.
We would happily be part of it. We're one tool in the toolbox to control feral animals. There's two types of shooting. There's ground shooting and aerial shooting. Aerial shooting is good for knocking down big numbers quickly, and then ground shooting is good to mop up in cases. But ground shooting needs to be coordinated by teams that have got the right equipment and the right resources and time. All the work that we do is ongoing. You can't just go out and hope to shoot all the pigs on a property or surrounding properties and then not go back for a year or 6 months and think that you've done your job. It's got to be constant. So it's very time involved.
Sporting Shooters is a national organisation. You've got members involved in the hunting side in every state and territory across Australia. What sort of resources could you put behind something like this, and just how effective do you think that would be in helping reduce the numbers?
How effective to reduce the numbers is how long is a piece of string, depending on what resources we could or would be put in our direction. We've got, I think, Sporting Shooters has 200,000 members Australia-wide, and there's about 60,000 in Queensland. Most of those do hunt at some stage, some just target shoot, and there's a lot of people that would be prepared to go out there, but they've got jobs and businesses to run, so it depends what the government's prepared to do and put towards resources, I suppose. Some areas trapping would be okay. Baiting would be beneficial, especially when it's dry, it's better. And then aerial as well. So it would be a coordinated effort depending on the area.
You personally have experience through AgForce in Queensland getting farming communities to work together specifically for pig control programs. Just how tricky is that task, and what is really the key to making that work?
The key to making it work is having a community that's tight-knit and generally have similar production systems, i.e. the PARU model for dog control, where they raised the participation rate to control wild dogs out around Cunnamulla was around 30%, but they raised it up over 90% participation. They had a great impact on reducing dog numbers and also pigs, because pigs are eating a lot of lambs. But then on other areas where they've got mostly cropping and pigs are the issues, where farmers get together and all chip in at the same time, regardless of whether pigs are on their property at the moment, they have a good result. They never get down to zero pigs. There's always some pigs left. So it's just a matter of reducing the numbers down to a level that isn't having a massive impact.
So recreational shooters could play a role in some regards in a sort of response like this. But how much of an issue is land access at the moment, actually getting onto country where pigs are located?
Getting onto country where pigs are located, it's a relationship challenge for a lot of people. Getting access is really making sure that you've got good, reliable people that respect the farmer's property, because it's his business and his home. So you need to respect that and have people that turn up, do the right thing, communicate well, and actually do a good job. No good turning up and sitting around and doing nothing. You've got to turn up and actually get good numbers and control the pests that are there.
At the moment, your members are already out hunting pigs, I assume, at the moment. Have they been made aware of what to look for in the population, the signs that we may see this disease in the population? Do they know what to look for and how to report it?
No, not really as yet. I haven't seen too much information from DPI or any other bodies as yet. I'm sure we'll hear about it if it does. As far as I know, it's up around Timor, Indonesia. That's where they've detected it. But I think if something like this comes to Australia, the pig producers will be very keen to have it controlled. But would a grain farmer who thinks, oh, geez, this fever comes and wipes out all the feral pigs, do I need to do anything?
That is Damien Ferguson from the Sporting Shooters Association of Australia, speaking there with Carmen Brown on the issue of fruit fly and those fines. Greg is a visitor from Western Australia, and he called earlier to say that he travelled to SA a couple of days ago and was surprised by the lack of facilities on the WA border for disposing of fruit. He says it's surprising given there's so much focus on the eastern entry, but no information for the western entrance until you get to Juna about what to do and places to get rid of fruit before reaching the quarantine zone. So definitely sounds like room for improvement there. It is 11 minutes to one. Let's go to the dairy industry now, because an online exchange for dairy farmers to forward sell either all or part of their milk production has been launched this week. Milk to Market's Milk Exchange describes itself as an online commodity trading platform for raw milk. So what does that actually mean? Richard Lang from Milk to Market explains the concept.
Milk Exchange is a significant innovation for the dairy industry. It's actually a market for milk. It's something that the dairy industry hasn't had for raw milk. And it's launching to provide a transparent digital supply chain for Australian buyers and Australian suppliers, which are dairy farmers.
So what do you mean by that? If I'm a dairy farmer, I have milk to sell and I wanted to sell it on this exchange. How does that work?
Well, we're anticipating that milk is traded on a contract-by-contract basis. It's unlikely that there's going to be a lot of milk around at the moment because most farmers are contracted to buyers. But we have buyers that have registered on the Milk Exchange and would like milk today, tomorrow, and next year even. And a farmer would, if they have uncontracted milk, could register on the exchange for whatever period. It could be a 1 month, 3 months, 6 months worth of milk. And that would be offered up on the exchange, and then buyers would be able to search and find the regions that they're seeking milk and make an inquiry. That trade is all anonymous, so it's totally anonymous from the buyer side and from the seller side. And then they offer up a price, which is either accepted or not, and then the milk is contracted.
Do you need to say how much milk it can be supplied in terms of volume or quality, etc.?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. The contract would be for a volume of milk with the fat and protein specified. It also specifies the quality of the milk, and it's an intended supply contract for the period of that contract. So that enables the buyer to decide whether it's going to fit their profile or what they're looking for. And it also has to match the supply that the farmer can produce. It's then traded at a price, a fat and protein price. If that's accepted and is, if you like, achieves the market value that is being offered for that period of time, then the trade will go forward. If it's out of or doesn't meet expectations in terms of the price, it's unlikely it will be sold, but it comes into the team here at Milk Exchange and it'll be to and fro. We think it'll be back and forth a few times before the deal is done. So it's quite an important process to make sure that we have price discovery. All the market information will be available on the exchange, and it also will be a case of any past sold contracts will be up on the exchange so people can see what the milk is worth in that region for that period, and they'll be able to decide whether that's going to be meet their requirements.
As you mentioned, traditionally in Australia, the dairy market is a farmer produces milk and they sign a contract for a given season with a company, and they pick it up and process it, whether that be one of the majors or one of the smaller dairy processing companies. Why would a farmer forego the traditional style of relationship being that and decide to sell their milk on an exchange online on something like your platform?
Well, Warwick, it'll be horses for courses. Some people will continue to trade in the traditional way, and that's fine. In fact, we would like farmers to keep an open mind in terms of keeping their traditional approach and maybe just trialing the exchange so they get a feel for it, because it is new. It's not something that farmers have had. It's unlike, if you like, beef farmers or grain or even wool. They're very used to offering a contract and trading their commodity onto a market. It's not something that dairy farmers have done in the past. We know that this is going to be an education process and a slow build, but we see it as a risk management tool to enable farmers to identify whether they can capture a bit more value for their milk, or actually even achieve what they believe is market value for their dairy, their milk commodity.
So rather than selling all of their milk, you could see them in some instances selling their excess supply through this means?
Yeah, it's possible. One of the things that we've thought a lot about is flat milk supply tends to get a higher price because there's a higher cost. It's possible for a farmer to split their contracts, on the exchange, offer up a flat contract for, it could be the full year's supply, but also then the surplus gets sold for the spring into the exchange as well for a different price.
That's Richard Lang, General Manager of Commercial Development at Milk to Market, speaking there to Warwick Long. Well, South Australian beekeepers are hoping to double their access to the state's public land in the coming months after the state government announced a new apiary task force. SA apiarists currently have 200 sites for keeping their hives during non-pollination season, so most truck their hives interstate for access to forage. South Australian Apiarists Association's Ben Hooper is a part of the task force and says its primary role will be to work with public land holders to increase the access.
The direct aim of the task force is to look at opening up access to resources for beekeepers. So basically exploring the possibility of where areas that are already in use can potentially be expanded for beekeeping activities, and then also opening up other areas that previously haven't been touched. So for example, there's some the South Australian government that's involved in forestry, so we're looking at having some sort of symbiotic relationship with them when they're not in there doing their activities. Potentially we can use some of those areas.
Well, that has been quite a contentious issue, this lack of access to public land for South Australian beekeepers. Is that the plan then, to open up that public land to encourage more South Australians to get involved in beekeeping?
Absolutely, for sure. So I guess if our small apiary industry has any chance of keeping pace with the expanding and changing horticulture and water agricultural activities, it's imperative that we have access to more flowers to feed the bees, to increase pollination services. It's as simple as that.
So will it be these organisations working together with different levels of government to actually bring about these changes?
Absolutely. We're very privileged to have everyone around the table from each of the departments that basically represent public land ownership, and they're all working together to try and make this a good fit for all parties involved. I guess we need to consider that we want no net loss for all parties involved, so some areas won't be suitable for bees. It's as simple as that. So it's just working out those areas that are and then trying to make it happen.
Aside from encouraging more people to get involved, does that mean that existing apiarists will have access to that land and not have to truck hives interstate?
For sure, yes. It'll be open to all parties involved in the beekeeping industry. The exact matrix hasn't been developed yet, but there would be some form of third-party group that would allocate the sites when they become available.
And how much of an increase are you hoping for?
Well, anything is better than what we have. So we're literally about 4,000 sites behind the next state, and then up to 7,000 and 8,000 beekeeping sites on public lands behind other states. So if we're particularly at around 200 sites in public lands at the moment here in SA, and for a start we'd love to double that, then work to expand it and ideally get to around 1,000 sites.
Is that likely?
It's a long shot. We're stepping in the right direction, so we've got to start somewhere, and we'll see where we land.
With the task force, I suppose, aside from meeting that demand from pollination industries, there is the benefit that the bees produce honey. But with the drought conditions, is that impacting that honey production, and will that in turn impact people getting involved in the industry?
It definitely does impact honey production. Collectively, South Australia had one of its worst years ever on record as far as honey producing goes, and then that in turn puts a lot more pressure on the production of protein, basically, to keep those bees healthy.
That is Southeast beekeeper and executive council member of the South Australian Apiarists Association, Ben Hooper. He was speaking with Grace Whiteside. More texts coming in on fruit fly. Brendan saying the new rules at Yamba or Pinneroo checkpoint are no longer full time. They're now called random. The new rule forces travellers to ditch fruit early, not knowing if the checkpoint is manned. If they come to the checkpoint in the future and it isn't manned, there is a risk they will drive through without dumping fruit. Thanks for your text, Brendan. And another quite a long text here from some unhappy visitors in SA, basically saying that they're from New South Wales and they were pulled up at the quarantine station at Yamba and were subsequently booked. They were under the impression that produce could be handed in as done previously, and when the inspector asked, they stayed and went to hand it in and then politely were told that they were getting a fine. This text is saying that along the roadway there is no signage stating you cannot hand it in and a fine is imminent. As late as last week, you can still hand it over at Pinneroo without a fine. Thanks for your text, Will. There's plenty more to follow up on this fruit fly issue, but that is about all the time we have left for On the Country Hour this Thursday. Just a reminder that there are total fire bans in place for 10 districts. And for more stories from across the country, just head to abc.net.au/rural and keep listening to the ABC throughout the afternoon for updates. We are, of course, your emergency broadcaster. Right now, though, it's news time, 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.